Wizard of Oz. We hear he is a wizard of whiz, if ever a whiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a whiz there was, the Wizard of Oz is one. Because of the wonderful things he does. We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
This is The Wizards of Money, your money and financial management series, but with a twist. My name is Smithy, and I'm a wizard watcher from the Land of Oz. This is part 6 of the Wizards of Money series, and it is entitled Democratizing the Monetary System. In this 6th edition of Wizards, we're going to take a look at the growing movement to democratize money. That is, people creating their own monetary systems and making credit creation and distribution a democratic process, which is a radical change from the US dollar-based mainstream monetary system of today. In this edition, we will hear some excerpts from a BBC interview with a reformed currency trader, and we will also interview the administrator of a small but democratic version of the Federal Reserve, where a currency called Bread Hours is growing in circulation in California. Let's start this edition of Wizards with a paradox. Paradoxes make for excellent exercise for the brain. A paradox is an apparent contradiction, a conclusion arrived at through logic, but whose end result doesn't seem to make sense. The resolution of a paradox often results in new thinking about an issue and a head-on challenge of the underlying assumptions. We'll call this paradox the activism money paradox. Suppose you are a non-profit organization that opposes income inequality, and in particular, you oppose the structure through which that inequality comes about, namely contemporary capital markets or stock markets and the international monetary system. The people you think you are helping the most are those at the low income end of the spectrum. You probably acquired the status of, or are sponsored by, a 501c3 organization that can accept tax-deductible contributions primarily in the form of national currency or simply US dollars in this country. Why does your organization need to raise US dollars? Because they need to trade. They need labor, supplies, and services to conduct their activism and advocacy activities. Much of the labor might not require any US dollars for those people or volunteers that donate their time. But usually there will be some positions and tasks for which US dollars are required, else the task will simply not get done. Supplies and services that might be needed might come in the form of travel expenses, stationery, computer equipment, and so forth. The proper method for acquiring such goods is through trade, and certainly the quickest way to complete these transactions is to exchange US dollars for the goods and services desired. So then your organization has to decide how it will raise US dollars from the markets of would-be philanthropists. These people would have to agree with the organization's goals of fighting income inequality brought about by contemporary capital and money markets. Your organization will be most successful and have the most outreach in the shortest period of time if it can raise a lot of money from a few people. Well, how did these people get so much excess money that they can support you? Well, they are unlikely to be any of the people you claim to be helping. That is, the low-income people who probably don't have too much extra to spare. They are most likely to be higher income or higher wealth people who have benefited greatly from contemporary capital and money markets, the very thing your organization opposes. So then, if you are very successful and raise lots of money to meet your goals, do you think you will smash the system you oppose and destroy the system that made your major funders wealthy enough to be able to contribute excess cash to you? No way. All you did was change the path of the flow of money. The money bought the goods and services you needed and then ended up back in the same system of capital markets and the international monetary system you oppose. The same for the money you spent on the people you were helping, which also ended up back in the same old monetary system. Nothing fundamentally has changed. You might have raised some awareness of the problems and caused some headaches for the authorities, but that's all. No doubt if your motives were genuine, your organization will have made some positive change, but the underlying structure of the system, the mechanics of the capital markets and the international monetary system have not changed. The contemporary monetary system depends on inequality for its survival. Importantly, it also depends on confidence that such inequality can be maintained or increased to bring in the desired return on invested capital. By participating in the monetary system and accepting funds originating from and going back to the same capital markets and international monetary system, you support this structure. By continuing to support the same monetary system you oppose, you haven't really challenged the root of the problem. In case you haven't noticed, all about some few losers in this round. So whose monetary system is it then? It's not yours, and it's not that of the people that you are helping. We already discussed this in Wizards Part 1. The basic building blocks of contemporary capital and money markets is just plain money, that legal tender that can be used in the trade for all goods and services and in the repayment of all debts. Plain money is first created by the Federal Reserve. Who just makes it up out of thin air? First as bank reserves and then later as currency or Federal Reserve notes as the public demands more cold hard cash. Secondly, and where most money is created, the private commercial banks make about 10 times this amount as deposit or checking account money simply through the loan creation process and once again out of thin air. The public has no input into either of these money or credit creation processes. Ultimately, the decisions on who gets access to credit and who gets it on reasonable terms is decided on the basis of what loans will bring in to the shareholders of banks a return on their invested capital at a level of around 20% in recent years. By this I mean that for every $1 of stock or equity capital that a shareholder invests in a bank, they will get back $1.20 after a year. This is called a 20% return on equity. While this is simply an accounting profit, which is purely an abstract notion, these profits will translate into wealth in the real sense of potential to buy goods and services because everyone accepts the US dollar as legal tender, good for all trade and in the repayment of all debts. Therefore, in no way, shape or form can the creation and initial distribution of the money we so depend on be considered a democratic process. It is ultimately driven by the profit targets desired by the major shareholders of banks, which is a very small segment of society. On top of these money or basic debt markets sit more complex debt markets outside of the banking system and, of course, the rest of the capital markets or stock markets where shareholders invest the US dollars they've accumulated in return for more of these dollars in the future. In the case of all entities that raise money on the public stock exchanges, known as publicly traded corporations, All company decisions will be primarily driven by the need to meet shareholder expectations in terms of required shareholder return on capital. Meeting shareholder expectations is necessary in order to retain access to the capital markets. Access to the capital markets is the make or break, or life or death, the very requirement for survival of a publicly traded company. And meeting shareholder expectations therefore drives all decision making. Consequently, the other main parties of a corporation, the employees and the customers and other affected members of the public, only have say in the corporation to the extent that they can influence the shareholders. The shareholders are mostly concerned with percent return on their investment. It is then fair to say that contemporary money and capital markets have built into them powerful driving forces that must undermine democracy for their very survival. Capital markets, which depend on accumulated money, could probably never be democratic because they are necessarily driven by the demands of shareholders. But what about money or credit, the basic medium of exchange? Can that be created democratically, and would that lead to a more democratic society and a fairer society where people really did have closer to equal opportunity? This is the subject of today's Wizards of Money. But before we discuss democratic money, it is perhaps best to discuss why we need money at all. The primary reason we need money is because human societies have found it desirable to run themselves using division of labor. In this way, some people can occupy themselves providing the things necessary for survival for the people in the society, such as food and shelter, leaving others free to invent and produce things that make life easier and more enjoyable in the material sense, such as electricity, transportation, and so forth. Without division of labor, people would have to produce their own food, shelter, and warmth within their own family unit or small community. This would keep people busy all the time occupied in these basic activities. Humans have achieved remarkable progress through division of labor, which has been facilitated through some commonly accepted medium of exchange, known as money. Money, accepted for trade in all goods and services, facilitates trade with people outside of your immediate neighborhood. Without money and wanting to trade goods and services with a broad range of people, humans would revert back to barter, which tends to result in very slow trade, small amounts of trade, and very slow technological developments. The availability and flow of money seems well correlated with pace and direction of technological development. Today, availability of money will depend on Federal Reserve and commercial banking decisions, as well as the desires of the capital markets. Both availability and flow will depend greatly on public confidence in the monetary system and the capital and debt markets built on top of it. Ideally, in a democracy, the people would decide what pace and in which direction technological development should go, and what activities should be encouraged and what should not. Then they could design their monetary system consistent with these values. At one extreme would be the system of limited trade and little technological development. If people wanted this, they could have no monetary system and everyone could go back to agrarian-like barter societies. They could alternatively have no money, but have centralized planning to force division of labor and development. But this tends to concentrate power into too few hands, which is very dangerous and, of course, ends up being undemocratic. At the other extreme, they could have maximum technological development and the fast money and fast pace of today that will accumulate lots of money if invested in such development. However, this will also tend to concentrate power in too few hands as human activities get oriented around ensuring that return on capital is achieved to maintain confidence in the system and its underlying monetary system. Most likely, the majority of humans in the present time would like a system that's somewhere in between these two. They would like a system that provided a more advanced life than the agrarian societies had, and so needed some division of labour and perhaps some monetary system to facilitate such development and to avoid centralised control or centralised planning. But many would also like a system that wasn't so driven by and dependent on rapid advancement and rapid consumption like we have today, but rather tended to promote a more sustainable future. People all over the world are in fact starting to design such monetary systems of their own to help achieve the goals of their own societies. We will now listen to some excerpts from the November 11, 2001 edition of the BBC's Global Business Report, where the growth in democratic money was being discussed. In this segment, the BBC interviews Bernard Lyotard, actually a reformed currency trader who understands why we need better money. We mentioned Mr. Lyotard in Wizards Part 1 as the author of the book The Future of Money.
How about money? It's a familiar enough thing, but there are interesting new ideas about money too.
Money has never been a democratic process, sorry to say. Historically, it has been dealt with by temples, by kings, or by central banks, and none of them have ever been elected.
Money. It is, of course, a great enabler. But it's also a curse, reducing everything to objects worth only the price we can put on them. Bernard Lyotard knows a lot about money. He was once named by the international magazine Business Week as the world's best foreign exchange dealer. He's also worked for the Belgian Central Bank, and he's now a writer and academic who's just written an ingenious book called The Future of Money. He's fascinated by the advantages of creating new types of money, time dollars in the United States, for example, enabling people to trade volunteer services without having to give them a price or money value. Bernard Lyotard says there are now some 3,000 of these so-called LETs, standing for local exchange trading systems, in many parts of the world.
They typically have arisen in pockets of high unemployment.
Where there is even more shortage of money than there is in the ordinary world.
Exactly. Say you're a dentist, you're in an area where there's 30% or 40% unemployment. Well, you have two choices. Move out of there, and, you know, like everybody else is doing. Or if you stay there, you better find a way where you can accept something that those people can do. And if they don't have a job, they can't have the pounds, and therefore, let's create their own currency. And it is, again, a mutual credit system. Now, what's important about this is that this creates community.
And community is one of the things that's being eroded by the way we live now. But the advantages of inventing what Bernard Lyotard calls complementary currency systems, or alternative monies, address more than merely our sense of community. We know that investors' hot money is hurtled around the world in seconds in huge foreign exchange markets, precipitating dangerous financial crises in vulnerable countries, and thereby threatening the lives and the jobs of countless people. Mr. Lyotard says the system needs new complementary currencies.
The current trend towards higher monetary instability is here to stay.
And it kind of ramps up, it gets worse every time it happens.
Yeah, there are bigger ones. I mean, we have actually, this relates to the volume of speculative activity in the foreign exchange markets.
And they echo around the world in this extraordinary way, so they leap from Latvia or Estonia to Argentina to to wherever in a matter of seconds. It's hair-raising for outside onlookers.
Yeah. Now, what do you do about this? Wait for the next one and put a candle, hoping that's not yours. The alternative is, let's create a safety net below the existing system. And the complementary currency types that I've been describing, I've only been describing a few examples here. There are 3,000 systems operational today, not half a dozen. With these safety nets below the existing system, if there is a problem in your currency, you will be a lot better off.
These are large and exotic ideas we're overhearing, and they don't yet get much of an airing in broadcasts or in the newspapers.
That was an excerpt from the BBC's Global Business Report on November 11th, 2001. There is, of course, absolutely no reason why a group of people who wanted to trade goods and services amongst themselves couldn't create their own monetary system. After all, money is just an arbitrary accounting system of credits and debits that we have let the Federal Reserve and the private banks design for us rather than having any input ourselves. using a democratic currency designed for a local or similarly ideologically inclined group. The benefits of the division of labor and trade within the group in that new currency would accrue entirely to that group and would not be sucked into the mainstream capital markets. Furthermore, this kind of resistance to mainstream money, if conducted on a large enough scale, has potential to put significant pressure on the mainstream monetary system and its associated capital markets to change its ways. That is, it has the potential to force fundamental structural changes. Contrary to some beliefs, it is not money that makes for the practical implementation of capitalism. It is positive return on capital. The argument behind having positive return on capital is compensation for financial risk. The capital holder could have realized the full value of their capital today by spending it on a real good, but instead they invested it in something else where they might lose the value of that investment, and so the argument goes that they should get compensated for this risk. One of the main places where this argument fails is that the only risk considered in this equation is financial risk to the capital investor. Completely ignored are social or environmental risks this investment creates, which, if factored in and charged to the investor, might make the properly risk-adjusted return unattractive to the investor so as to discourage such investment. A group of people might choose to create their own currency with zero interest to remove any incentive to accumulate excess capital over labor and goods input into the system. This would provide for more equitable distribution and access to the medium of exchange and would remove incentive for excessive appropriation of natural resources. Then they may also decide to create money through various means such as loans and grants made through some democratic decision-making process. A new currency could be created for trade within a local community or even across a broader geographic region with some other association, say such as members of a national coalition of NGOs working on similar issues. We discuss all these issues and more in the following interview with Dina Macken, the main administrator of the Bread Hours currency. No, she's not the equivalent of Alan Greenspan for Bread Hours, because this money is created democratically and it has no duty to please Wall Street. The technical and social challenges of implementing alternative currencies are not insignificant and should not be underestimated. Also, as we shall see in the following interview, where such currency independence is most needed, that is, in the developing world, it has not only been successful, but it has been seen as a threat by the National Central Bank and government. As we learn in the following interview, this was the case with a successful local currency that flourished after the 1997 attack on the Thai currency, the Thai baht. Here is the interview with Dina Macken of the Bread Hours currency, which is a community currency based in San Francisco. Their website is located at www.breadhours.org.
I thought we'd just start talking about monetary policy in the Bread Hours system.
Okay.
So if you could just explain for people who wouldn't be familiar with the system, basically how money gets created.
Okay.
And who creates it under the Bread Hours system?
Okay. Okay, so basically, Bread started about 4 years ago, and it was started by a group of people that decided to come together after learning about it in reaction to the issues of consequences of globalization and the monetary policy that was happening with the World Bank and IMF. They realized how much monetary policy was central to a lot of the problems that were happening around the world, and decided that it was one of the solutions that really needed to be examined and used. So they put together a decided that they were going to join this collective. And so basically what they did was look around and created a money that they printed, and they just broke it down into denominations and printed it up and then distributed it to new members. Each new member gets 4 hours worth, and I'll explain what an hour is in a minute. And as you get those hours, you sign the back of it. And it's not until you actually spend the money and someone else takes it that it actually becomes currency that is in circulation.
Mm-hmm.
So in one way, it seems kind of strange because all we had to do was go to a printer, you know, and print up piles and piles of money. But it's not real. It's not really actually in circulation until it's actually being used. Someone actually has a need
that's
fulfilled by the money.
If we were to look at the comparison between your money and mm-hmm. the American dollar, one difference would be that the way that money gets created. So we know, we've been discussing in Wizards of Money, that money gets the US dollar is getting created firstly by Alan Greenspan at his meetings when he announces interest rates, and secondly by the banks when they create loans. And that's not a democratic decision at all, that creation of money. So what you're saying is money is really coming into existence as people need it. Is that right? So as a transaction is needed, then any member of the currency system, that's when that money starts really coming into existence. Not when they become a member, but when they start their first transaction.
Exactly.
Okay. So how would you explain to people who are very new to this concept, how does that help mitigate some of these problems of globalization?
Well, for one thing, the way it works right now is that we've got companies and you buy your products that are produced by multinational companies. And so the products are being produced by people in other countries that are being exploited, don't have rights to protect themselves, to make safe environments, brought over to our country. We buy it, and then the profits of that go to a anonymous stockholders that don't have any invested interest in making sure that the system is fair or that it's environmentally safe. And basically the money that is produced by, or the value that's produced by these people in other countries, and then the amount that the consumers pay for it, that difference of value that is the profit gets drained out of those communities and into the hands of the stockholders, which tend to be a limited number of people that already had a lot of money to begin with to buy the stock.
Right.
Well, a local currency keeps the value that is produced by the people that are the producers and the consumers in the local community, because with the local currency, any value that's produced can't leave that that currency.
Mm-hmm.
It's just passed on to the next group of people. So in that way, you can't... that's one of the ways that it does it. Another thing is the way our denominations are set up, which is by hours.
Mm-hmm.
And the currency is, instead of saying, well, that we have $1 equals one bread, we have... it's done by you trade an hour, and an hour is worth $12, and so when people are trading, they're trading based on their labor. So no one's going to be valued for an hour of service that they provide for less than $12 an hour.
And what about at the other end? Could you have a situation in your currency where someone comes along and they basically want to accumulate a ton of bread hours? Can you have a greedy capitalist develop under your system or not, where they can accumulate lots and lots of money?
Well, the thing about accumulating lots and lots of bread hours in such a small circulation system is that they start pulling all of it out of of circulation and hold on to it, which means that less people are going to be able to use it elsewhere. They're not going to be able to keep it moving so that okay, so what would happen if you accumulate too much is that you end up not being able to have places to spend it, because it means that less people are going to be a part of the system because it's not available.
Isn't it true that there isn't a motivation to hoard because there is no interest? Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly.
On your currency.
One of the central pieces of the local currency movement is to not have any kind of interest charged on any loans that are made.
Right.
So, some local currencies so far have given out loans where they have no interest loans, so that the people that when they pay them back are paying back the exact same amount as they borrowed.
Okay, are these the local currencies like LETS, the local exchange trade system, that allow negative balances as well?
The one I'm actually thinking of is Ithaca Hours.
Okay.
Which is also a decentralized system that uses currency based on the hour like ours.
Right. So you're saying, though, that they actually create money by making loans, is that correct?
Yes, they do.
Okay. This program, The Wizards of Money, airs as part of a radio show called Unwelcome Guests, and I believe that Ithaca, New York, is in its signal area.
Okay.
So could you explain some of the differences between Bread Hours and Ithaca Hours?
Well, we actually based our conception on Ithaca Hours and built it based on theirs. Theirs is about 10 years old and has been able to develop to a point where it has reached a critical mass where a good portion of their businesses accept it, including mm-hmm. the bowling alley and grocery stores and other basic places that people go on a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm.
People have been known to pay their rent with it. They can pay medical bills with their hours. And we haven't been able to get ours to that point yet.
Right.
It requires a lot of outreach.
Mm-hmm.
And so because they've been able to do that, people have joined for a number of different reasons, but basically a lot out of curiosity and stuff.
What about the whole issue of the broader economy entering a recession and people losing jobs and moving to lower paid jobs? Is that creating an increase in interest in these local currencies?
Yeah, actually, during the Great Depression, 300 local currencies propped up. The local currency actually is most useful during recessions and depressions
mm-hmm.
because the depression is about the absence of money being available.
Right.
And so what I have seen in the last couple weeks, or months actually, is a difference in attitude of the members and people coming in to join Bread, which is it used to be that people would be interested in it for the ideological reason of it.
Right.
And lately I've seen more people coming in a desperate need to find something in order to make ends meet.
Okay, that's interesting.
They're trying to get themselves another job.
Has the local government or the city council been supportive of this currency for that reason? And that is that basically, you know, we're in an environment now of post-welfare reform, and a lot of benefits have run out in 2000, 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And so people have no safety net if they don't have access to employment, they don't have access to the mainstream monetary system. I would think that that would mean that local governments and city councils in areas where money has basically left the community would be very interested. Is that what you're seeing?
They have been very supportive of it so far. They haven't jumped onto it to a level where they want to be a member and accept it.
Mm-hmm.
But we have found that the left and the right, for different reasons, both are in strong support of the idea of local currencies.
Mm-hmm.
Because it supports the idea of pull yourself up by your bootstraps and, you know, the entrepreneurship
right.
and stuff, and promotes trading and economic activity. And at the same time, it gives the opportunity for, you know, money to be changing hands and among the disadvantaged, and gives new people opportunities to get money that haven't, that don't have it, or are marginalized by the economic system.
So it's sort of like trying to work towards a healthy economy, but without big corporations dominating everything.
Exactly, and I think that is basically one of the founding ideas that we are existing on.
So what would you do if Walmart came along and said, I'm going to accept bread hours?
I think that we would have a real ideological problem with
right.
that,
mm-hmm.
because it really defeats the reason for having the local currency in the first place.
Right. And and can you talk about, like, the take-up of this by small businesses, both in your area and in other areas where you've watched local currencies developed?
I think in different places it has varied to a degree. In our neighborhood, in our area, we've had about 30 businesses that have joined. The businesses that tend to join are the ones that are smaller, less popular, possibly newer. The thing about joining a local currency is that there is a risk involved, because they don't know if they're going to end up with an accumulation of
mm-hmm.
this currency that they can't get rid of.
Right.
So, in general, as I've worked on outreach with this, I've gotten to know that local business owners tend to be pretty conservative, because their primary concern is protecting their own business.
Right.
And so the benefit that you can use the local currency for is that it can be an edge up on the competition.
Mm-hmm.
It basically can work like a coupon, where you can say you are able to use as much or little, accept as much or little of the local currency as you want.
Right.
You could say we're only accepting a quarter of the price in local currency. Well, then it works kind of like a coupon that you've offered out and said, with this coupon, you get 25% off. But the benefit is that then you get to use that quote-unquote coupon to buy other things with, or
right.
for your employees with.
Right. And is that what happened? Do you see that them actually using it in to pay out, like, part salary in bread hours?
Yeah, people have been paying out partly salary, and that might be one of the most common ways to use it.
One of the criticisms I've heard of local currencies, and, you know, people saying that local currencies are a good solution to a lot of our problems with dominations by large corporations and the current international monetary system, is, well, how does it deal with the issue of distribution of basically the classic problems, land and food and things like that, the basics of life. And I guess this is more of a, this may be more of a problem for people in developing nations, that basically the international monetary system has worked against them, and we've seen all the currency speculative attacks and stuff that have made their economies even weaker. Do you see that these currencies could be used to solve those bigger type issues?
They have been used in those ways.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely. Some of the places that have been really successful with local currencies have been Bolivia and Thailand. Thailand's incidentally recently got shut down by the government.
Yes. That's very interesting, because in the last edition of Wizards, we spoke about, and also in the second edition of Wizards, we spent a lot of time on the 1997 speculative attacks against the Thai baht, and how that happened and what the implications were for the people of Thailand. Did this currency exist before and during the attacks on the Thai baht?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Why did it get closed down, and when did it get closed down?
It was closed down sometime last year.
Mm-hmm.
And
because you're talking about a period when the baht had been devalued by about 40%, you know.
Uh-huh.
So you would think that local currency would be a great solution
right.
to that. Did the government step in and close it down?
Yeah, it was the government that shut down the local currencies.
Uh-huh.
For one thing is that the idea of a local currency comes off to a lot of people as very subversive. And, you know, it takes a lot of the centralized power over the economy mm-hmm. out of the hands of the national government.
Right.
And so while it actually, if they were to look at it in terms of what's going to be best to motivate our economy, it actually is a very rational thing to be able to support and allow to happen.
Right.
The idea of it's quite threatening, particularly if you have a troubled national currency. And this means that, people aren't even going to need the national currency so much anymore, which will lower the value of it even more.
Do you think any motivation for that actually originally came from Wall Street, who may have, one of the problems is if Wall Street perceives, in this era of free capital flow, if Wall Street perceives that a currency is going to get weaker,
mm-hmm.
then they just attack it like crazy, which is exactly what they did with the Thai baht in 1997.
Okay.
And so the government and the central bank of that country feels obliged to do whatever they can to make it look like the baht can, remain strong.
Mm-hmm.
And so that Wall Street basically won't attack their currency.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if there was some interplay of those factors going on that caused the government to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing we've been talking about is the trend towards dollarization. I don't know if you've seen this happen.
Yeah, we find it a really interesting thing that, we're on the other extreme of it.
Yes.
But many, Ecuador, Russia, many countries have been taking the dollar as their national currency.
Right, and you would think in that situation that the only way, that's obviously accelerated globalization to a point beyond which, there's no return. It's very interesting to me that you're saying that Thailand won't allow its people to set up a local currency. Have you seen that happen in another country where people have had a local currency shut down?
Well, I haven't actually seen it because I haven't spent so much time studying and researching international local currencies.
Mm-hmm.
We've spent more time studying the other local currencies in the United States.
Right, and
the U.S. is supportive of it, so.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we have the strongest currency,
right?
So I guess they don't find it a threat.
They don't find it threatening,
right? We're just talking about these attacks against the Thai baht and various other international currencies.
Uh-huh.
A local currency would be really, by definition, free of Wall Street speculative attacks. Is that correct? Right.
Because you can't trade it back and forth between dollar and the currency,
mm-hmm.
You can't really speculate against it.
So you can't redeem the hours. I can't, if I have lots of bread hours, I can't redeem them for national currency.
No, you could sell them to other people, which has happened.
Right.
There are people that are interested in getting enough large amounts of bread available to them
mm-hmm.
that they'll buy it from you. But on a central level, we don't do it. We don't pass them back and forth between the two. On the other hand, we do have a reserve of money available in case the currency collapses and
okay.
we need to bail people out.
Okay. Issue money sort of to these new people that sign up as members, and the way it's coming into circulation is it's coming in on a sort of an as-needed basis, so that really helps with stop any inflation or deflation problems. What would happen if all of a sudden you found that the number of transactions was not, or that the amount of money in circulation was not keeping up with the volume of transactions? Would you issue new currency to the members to deal with that?
If that was the case, then we do institute other kinds of projects that would put more currency in circulation mm-hmm. besides just handing out money. We would probably offer loans to
okay.
people. And this way, people are able to invest in doing some kind of project that they can, you know, pay with the local currency. And then as they are able to get the money back, they can either pay us in local currency or they can pay us in U.S. dollars.
Okay, so well, that's a very interesting point about the loans, because that's sort of getting into the traditional way of how money is created.
Right.
So what I'd like to, but the key point there is sort of who makes the decisions about how that money gets created. And as we know, you know, in the current monetary system, most of the money is being created by the banks making loans, and that so that decision belongs with private bankers
uh-huh.
who just make loans based on, you know, how much interest that the borrower can bring back. In your case, if you did start making loans, how would, or if we look at, say, how Ithaca Hours does it, who makes the decisions on whether or not a loan gets granted and for what purpose the loan is granted?
We are run as a democratic collective of mm-hmm. volunteers that are actually members.
Right.
And the amount of participation of the members will... Anybody is free to participate in these kind of decision making.
Okay, so it would be, say, a majority vote, does this person get a loan or not get a loan? Is that
right.
how it would work? Okay,
right.
that's very interesting, and it's a very key difference with that.
And in fact, it's more like a consensus process than it is a majority vote.
Okay.
So
if you, even if you have one dissenter?
Yes, but the fallacy or the lack of understanding that people have if they're not familiar with consensus is it's not a simple one dissent means that the issue is closed.
Mm-hmm.
It means that we continue to discuss it until everyone is satisfied with the answer.
Okay.
So that often means that on some level there's some kind of compromise or that you continue to think about it until you really have a clear idea of, you know, where everyone feels. And so no one has the power to be dismissed.
Right.
You know.
Okay. But if this is a case of a small business or I don't know, a market gardener or someone wanting a loan,
uh-huh.
And a lot of people thought, well, that's going to be really good, and it also more loans coming into the economy means you know, more economic growth and, you know, sort of a healthier economy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but that could, the consensus approach could conceivably, you know, throw some friction sort of into the system and slow things down a bit. So I guess there's
right.
a trade-off there.
There is a bit of a trade-off, but there's also the comfort for the people that are participating.
Right.
That they are, their voice is going to be heard.
Right.
If they feel motivated enough and feel invested enough that they feel like they need to have their voice heard,
right.
that it's not going to be able to be dismissed.
One thing I've been thinking a lot about local currencies is, especially when it comes to the NGOs, I don't know how this would link in, but the Achilles heel of a lot of NGOs is raising money.
uh-huh.
And I just often wonder to myself, well, why aren't they more involved in this area of local currency so that they could get the things that they need that they would otherwise use national currency for
mm-hmm.
by being, you know, going into these local currencies and somehow raising, you know, they would earn local currency from some of the stuff that they do, and or people would donate to them in local currency, and then they would be able to turn around and buy some of the services they need. Have you seen that happen at all?
That's actually where we've had most of our, where we've been distributing most of our money lately,
mm-hmm.
is through grants to other nonprofits in the area that are putting on projects for the local area.
So you make grants?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, we do. We make
okay.
up to 50 hours, and 50 hours is the equivalent of, let's see, $600.
Mm-hmm.
So we have granted people to start a farm, an urban garden,
mm-hmm.
That is producing food, and they were actually able to pay for the seedlings and the mulch and other essential materials with the local currency to start it. We've supported a at this place called the Rose Street House of Music, which is a local venue for folk artists, and helping them create their advertising and their materials for it, and other things like that. And then another popular thing is to pay their volunteers in local currency.
Have you worked at all with like community media, so community radio, community television?
Yeah.
Okay.
We are actually across the street from KPFA. So we have been interviewed a few times over the years, and now seems like another good time with the WTO coming up and stuff.
Right.
To continue to talk to them. We've also been interviewed regularly by our local newspaper, the Daily Californian, and then the Berkeley Daily Planet. And interviews with national papers, actually, the Christian Science Monitor and the Wall Street Journal. And then also just the city newspapers, the Examiner, the San Francisco Chronicle, the San Francisco Guardian.
On the issue of, like, community radio, is there potential for these local currencies so that people, you know, or the currency issuer could pledge in local currency, which may help them overcome some of their financial difficulties?
There definitely is that possibility. It hasn't been approached yet. We haven't really gone in that direction. We've been focusing on outreach in other places.
Right. I saw the article that you had on your website. I think it was from the Daily Californian. And I noticed that they had alluded to the fact that no one's going to give you any trouble as long as you're not too successful. And I was wondering to myself, first of all, what sort of did the Wall Street Journal give you favourable coverage? And do you think they'll, if these currencies become really quite successful, do you think there'll be some rumblings from Wall Street?
The Wall Street Journal did give us favorable coverage. It's the kind of thing that would really interest Wall Street.
Right.
And I really don't think that it's conceivable that we would ever be success. Like, a great deal of success to us would never touch the security of Wall Street.
Okay.
I don't think that any amount of success on our level would ever concern them.
Okay.
Because our purpose is to stay within the local area.
Right.
And even when, for instance, Ithaca Hours has been able to do a lot of amazing things with their currency, that people are being able to pay for their medical services in it.
Right.
But we're still talking about a circulation of about $1 million.
Right.
And in the grand scheme of Wall Street,
it's not
$1 million of circulation is among people that are already economically marginalized, and that is just small potatoes compared to, you know, what Wall Street's interested in.
So. Right. My thinking is that if it took off, you know, to the extent that there was lots of local currencies around.
Oh, everywhere, right.
And you know, when you say, well, it involves people who've been marginalized, that's basically taking cheap labor out of the hands of Wall Street. And
economically speaking, local currencies are most valuable in a place that is economically marginalized or in a state of depression.
Right.
That the reason why they work is because where you have places that you've got plenty of potential consumers and potential producers, but what they have a lack of is the material to trade with,
right?
Which would just be currency.
Mm-hmm.
The local currency is a very useful tool,
right?
Because it gives people an opportunity to get back to work, and they can be issued this money, and then other people can spend it. It doesn't really have much of an effect in a place that's where everybody's already has a job and they're too busy to actually be doing anything else above and beyond
the
job.
Okay, so you see sort of in the United States where we have lower unemployment here and have historically, and also you probably don't have the same motivation for setting up a local currency as you might have in these other places. So I guess what I'm asking is, do you see this more as a sort of a supplemental thing here in the United States, supplemental to the national currency?
It is a supplemental thing in the United States. It's a thing that works well for the marginalized, for the people that are where the chronic unemployment in the area is higher.
So people who are already shut out of the national currency system.
Exactly.
Okay.
The people that are find it really useful in a well-off area like the Bay Area are small upstart businesses that are looking for an edge on their competition.
Right.
We have a lot of unemployed people and disabled people that are in our system. People that can't do the regular kind of work week for some reason or another, but can really make use of this much more spurious form of trading.
Yes. Okay. If you also think about the people who are on minimum wage here, obviously minimum wage is much lower than the value of a bread hour or an Ithaca hour, and this is thinking much further down the track. But wouldn't people on minimum wage, if they could get, at the moment certainly they can't get as many hours as they might need, but wouldn't bread hours be quite attractive? If you look at people who are, say, on two or three jobs on the minimum wage, wouldn't it become more attractive to them to become involved in a local currency so they could cut down the number of hours for the same amount of money? Doesn't that kind of behaviour, you know, make Wall Street very upset? But that's thinking about, you know, if the currencies become really,
really
well known.
Right.
Yeah.
It would be hard to say, because there are people that have a low-paying job and are supplementing their income with the local currency.
Right.
But again, as I said, the difference between having a regular wage-based job earning dollars and the currency and using the currency to make money is that the currency is a lot more spurious. You're depending on people to actually call you and request your services, so that it's much more of just an opportunity to get some extra cash.
Yeah. Okay. So, like you say, supplemental.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess also the other main point is that, you know, we are a society very dependent on electricity and other, you know, oil and all these goods that you just wouldn't be able to buy with a local currency. So people would certainly not be able to survive without a significant chunk of their money coming in US dollars, unless they, you know, gave up some of those luxuries.
Mm-hmm. They can pay for housing and food, local currency.
Yeah.
So they can pay for some basic
needs,
but not necessarily the things that are going to be nationalized, you know, any kind of, like, transportation, buses or airplanes are not going to be able to be a part of it.
Right. And electricity.
Electricity.
Yeah.
And, the other utilities.
Well, I suppose maybe it's an opportunity for someone to set up a windmill in their backyard or something.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, well, I think that just about does it. Thanks very much for your time.
That was the interview with Dina Macken of the Bread Hour System in San Francisco. And that does it for Wizards of Money Part 6. Note that the Wizards of Money has a website at www.wizardsofmoney.org, where you can find the text of all episodes of Wizards and get more references. Oh,